Welcome back to the Neuro Network. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Trevor Day, a professor of physiology at Mount Royal University in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. Dr. Day is a physiologist whose work spans high altitude expeditions to Nepal, human adaptation to extreme environments, and a passion for putting science on stage. Beyond the lab, Dr. Day has spent years blending art and science, working in storytelling, music, and public engagement to make research more accessible and more human. In this episode, we talk about why great data isn't enough anymore. We explore the tension between rigor and research, why scientists are trained to lead with caveats instead of clarity, and how confidence, humility, and storytelling shape public trust in science. So from peer review to social media, from improv to impact, this conversation asks a simple question. If science is a human endeavor, shouldn't we get better at telling human stories about it? Dr. Trevor Day, welcome back to the show. Thanks for coming on.
Hi, Nick. Thanks for having me back again. It was great fun last time and looking forward to talking about something a bit broader than just specific scientific findings.
Yeah, than just climbing up Mount Everest and all of the other, you know, casual things that you do with the lab.
Yeah, well, but I should be clear, I've never climbed Mount Everest. I'm a semi-obese middle-aged man. I'm not a climber, but I like the stories anyway. I like the physiology.
Yeah. Yeah. I caught on, you know, first when I was a trainee, you know, we were studying goats and CO2 and all these different gases. And then I went to some of your talks as a trainee and it had all these pictures of the mountains when you went to, Everest Base Camp and were taking your students up. And I always envisioned you guys, you know, strapping backpacks with the whole lab, walking up a mountainside, and then realized that, you know, sitting with a goat at the middle of the night, drawing blood actually wasn't that bad.
It was fine.
It was still relatively easy, but you know, one of the things that I don't know if I even asked last time that you were here, but you know, you are interested, or a lot of your lab has been focused on studying human adaptation to extreme environments like high altitude. How did you get into that work?
Well, the thing about this kind of high altitude work is at least the goats show up on time, right? So corralling humans from, you know, a bedroom into another bedroom, which is now a lab, is difficult sometimes. So there's different strengths and weaknesses to working with animals versus humans, right? But as you know, I trained in sort of comparative animal physiology early in my career for my PhD. But, you know, I had an early career as a lifeguard and emergency medical technician. So I spent about 4 years, you know, wearing a polyester uniform and driving fast. But I became really interested in how we respond to physiological stressors like challenges in extreme environments, and breathing really captured my attention at the time. But I think what really tipped it for me was in my undergrad, I took a course on environmental physiology. Most of them were like climbing guides, and I was the neurobiologist, you know, trainee in the back wondering what I'm doing here. But we read John Krakauer's book Into Thin Air about the 1996 Everest disaster, one of the worst Everest disasters that year. And those stories about high mountains and the drama that happens to them capture my imagination. I've never been a high altitude alpine climber, but I spent a lot of time in the mountains. We live in Kenmore, just outside of Calgary in the mountains. But I never imagined I'd see the Himalayan range, those Himalayan mountains, until I got suckered into going on a high altitude research expedition with Phil Ainslie in 2012. And I found myself staring across the Khumbu Glacier at Everest herself. And sort of found myself in this place that I never imagined I'd be. So I went on to organize or co-organize my own expeditions to Nepal, to Everest Base Camp, up and down, using kind of an incremental ascent model, where we fly up to 2,800 meters, we trek to 34, take a rest day test, go to 38, take a rest day test, up to 43, take a rest day test, up to 5,000, take a rest day and test. Jeez. And so that incremental ascent model, you know, you can ask some questions with that, but you're always changing the stressor. So it has some caveats and weaknesses as opposed to, say, going to one altitude in one lab and staying there for a period of time. But we did five expeditions to Nepal, 2016, 17, 18. That was a busy 3 years, 2023 with Tom Brutzar from Syracuse University and Abby Bigham from UCLA. And international collaborators, White Mountain, California, with my old supervisor from my PhD, Richard Wilson, and I organized the Barcroft Lab in 2019. And then we also organized La Paz, Bolivia in 2023. with Gustavo Zubieta's Institute there in La Paz. And we're planning to, Tom and I and Abby are going to go back to Peru this summer for some work with Andean Islanders. So it's become a big part of my research program. And it all really just started with taking an undergrad course and reading a book that turned on my imagination. I cut you off.
I was saying the storytelling aspect of science that you bring up. So yeah. that was one of the whole reasons one of the reasons I reached out to you, and I reached out to you a couple months ago about doing this, is that, you know, I had a episode before that I had recorded, and something that's always kind of been a passion, and it's been sparking up a little bit more and more, at least at meetings and stuff you hear, is about kind of the lack of science communication, or maybe the disconnect that there is with science communication lately. And maybe it's something that's always been there, but now just the more mediums that are available to express views about lack of science communication. But you mentioned there was a story in the thin air that caught your attention and sort of brought you into the interest of a certain research topic. And I remember when I was a trainee, you know, you're standing at your poster and nobody's ever there because you're usually on the last day. And so for anyone that's interested, a scientific session at a symposium or something is you stand there by your poster and people come by, and depending on whose group you're in, you may get grilled and, you know, called certain names, or you may just be standing there with nobody. But usually your first few years, you just stand there and nobody's there. And I remember vividly, we were doing the work on different exposure to gases, and you had come by and were interested in talking about some of our research. And it was sort of one of the first people that was, you know, kind of introduced me into how to interact with other people in the scientific community outside of just my lab space. And so, and I know one of the things that I enjoyed about at least yourself and your work was your ability to kind of frame things in a story. And so it felt fun. It was like you saw the origins of where this project comes from, what it means, where it's connected even within the local cultures and stuff that you're doing. And so it just kind of created this whole storytelling aspect of it rather than just this data set, like here's a bunch of data, like it or not. And so when I reached out, one of the things that I wanted to do, and I know that's one of the passions of yours, is getting involved in that scientific communication or outreach, or put, like you said, putting science on stage. I know I like that one, but what kind of brought you into, or what led you to have a passion of being, you know, more story focused with the data rather than just pure analytical?
Oh, that's good. Well, I'm glad I made a good impression back then. It wasn't that long ago that I feel like I was a trainee standing at a poster by myself too. And they can be a bit dry, these sessions, unless there's a bar nearby. But, really is all about, I heard recently someone say, no data without stories and no stories without data. I think that's a lovely way of kind of summarizing the importance of storytelling in science. We can bring it to life with story and connect with people that way, but also we can't just tell a story without data. So there has to be some accuracy or truth to it too. Your science on stage thing really resonates with me, because what I didn't say in my background is I also have a musical theater and live music playing background as well, and recorded a CD of original music during grad school, much to my supervisor's chagrin, I think, in terms of feeling a bit distracted by these competing demands of art and science. But I took a training program, it must have been in my head, but in 2008, I was a new prof, assistant professor at this university. And I took this 2-week residency program at a place called the Banff Center. And it's this little artist commune in Banff, right in the Rocky Mountains, you know, an hour and a half from Calgary. And it's kind of a artist training center. And these mentors have become mentors and friends of mine, put on this 2-week training program for over a decade, where scientists would come for 2 weeks and learn how to tell stories in different kind of media, writing, video, podcasting, that kind of stuff. And it really kind of captured my interest, because I felt like I'm not sure if I really found my people yet at that point about the way I think about science and communication. And so my mentor, Jay, who's Jay Ingram, is a sort of a public figure, writer, broadcaster in Canada. And he gave this talk that really kind of captured my attention, which he called Watson and Crick, Lennon and McCartney. And he tried to make a parallel between creative duos or creative teams, you know, using the writing and recording of Strawberry Fields by the Beatles to the finding of the double helix for the shape of the DNA molecule with Watson and Crick, with all kinds of input from other people, like Rosalind Franklin, for instance. You know, that kind of way of thinking about science as a creative endeavor and as a team sport really kind of, you know, made me feel like I found my people for the first time. And then I asked Jay offhand, hey, would you give a talk for Darwin's 200th birthday, which is 2009? And he said, well, you know, I don't have a Darwin talk in the can, but I've always wanted to work with a band because no one ever puts science on stage with music. And I realized I had my in. And so I said, well, I can put a 5-piece together. And the rest is history. We've gone on to, since 2009, we've done over 40 different performances on different stages of 20 different distinct specific shows about the brain, about the moon, about Mars, all kinds of different aspects about science. We've got a show coming up this April about our fascination with the moon. Perfect timing with respect to Artemis II, hopefully heading up without problems the next few weeks. So that's kind of where it started for me anyway.
Do you guys write your own songs for it? I suppose.
Yeah, it depends on the show. So The Giant Walk Through Your Brain was this show that was sort of about taking this idea of a science center and a huge actual brain that you could walk into and look around and go to the amygdala, go to the hippocampus, go to the brainstem, and tell stories about neuroscientists and patients. You know, HM, for instance, is a story that psychology students would be familiar with, who got a, you know, a tamping rod blown through his brain and it changed his personality. Sorry, I'm thinking about Phineas Gage. Which was the, you know, this idea of taking out a portion of the hippocampus because of some seizures and affected his ability to make new memories. So these kinds of stories about patients and physicians, Alzheimer's, the first Alzheimer's patient, inspired us to write some original music for that show. But every show is different, and we love going through sort of the archive of all of music and finding either a stem like a talk show band or a full song that illustrates whatever Jay's talking about on stage. So it's a mix of everything, really.
Interesting. So one of the things that came up that is something that I think I had written down that I wanted to ask you, and it was to serendipitous that you brought it up, but you mentioned the Watson and Crick and, you know, the connection between that and the double helix and, you know, putting it sort of in a storytelling mode and putting it with Lennon and McCartney. Yeah. Sorry. Making the comparison there. And with the Watson and Crick and Rosalind Franklin type thing, when you put them all together and you put it in the whole broad thing, there's this aspect of making these, you know, pivotal discoveries in science that push forward things. But one of the things that I kind of also think about first when I hear that, though, is that there's a bit of a drama aspect to it. You know, when you go through the genome race, you know, when you look at the who was the first to, you know, be able to sequence the genome, or, I mean, they were looking at the double helix structure, but I'm expanding it out into that human genome race that came through. And there was this, I know there's a documentary that was put on it, and it was talking about, you know, certain groups trying to be the first ones to transcribe how this DNA code was actually put within the human body. And there was this drama of this back and forth and people who agreed and people who disagreed. And I know in our field, because we are in the same field, we study different things, but we're in the same field. And back, you know, back in the day, the field was a lot more ripe with either drama pieces that had some sort of conflict of this group thought that the mechanism of how something works in the brain is this way, and this group thought the other way, and those that associated with one versus the other. And it was sort of like these factions created it. But I think what it did was it really pushed the science, the innovation, the drive, the motivation to push things through. And I now know, and I know now there's, at least in our field, there's less of that heated drama that there was. There's nobody standing up and throwing pens at screens anymore at meetings. But where do you think, though, that you know, do you think by having less drama within certain fields that it kind of dampens how the progression of science, or does it have kind of a double-edged sword where it kind of, with that, it makes people try to go too fast and then they're not as careful because they're just trying to beat the other group?
Right. And just, you know, hit productivity metrics. Yeah, that's it. It's a really good question. You know, we were just before we got on the call, just talking about a senior person in our field, a mentor of ours who was from those days. And he was telling me these stories when he was visiting me recently about, you know, these kind of battles that would happen at conferences. And they'd book an extra session in an extra room and go at it and put up whiteboards and just fill out all the data and then try and convince each other. And there's a lot of screaming. And I'm torn about this too, because I think, you know, competition is what drives innovation in so many ways. And so that kind of risk of getting scooped from some other lab group, you know, pushes you a little harder to work a little harder and do a better job. But there's, I think the downside of that is that serves a particular kind of person. And if we want to truly embrace more diversity and retain a more diverse group of people in science, then that way of behaving isn't always going to work, right? And so I'm torn about it too. I think getting beat up a little bit by your friends and your enemies helps you just sharpen your thinking and do a better job next time, and helps push the work forward. But then, you know, if we drive good people away, then I don't think we've won either. And so I'm not sure what the answer is. Perhaps we can learn to challenge each other a bit more gently, to retain a broader perspective of people and the way they live in the world, as opposed to just screaming and yelling and thinking that somehow is gonna win the day or motivate people. But I think that kind of, like, broadly speaking, that kind of conflict or controversy or competition is probably what makes science so interesting in some ways. And I think what sometimes we miss in terms of communicating with the public is, this is why, you know, game shows or the sports or sports are so interesting to people, because ultimately these are competitions. And if we can tell these stories about, you know, conflicts, resolving conflicts, competition in science, to show that it's actually a human endeavor, it's not just about the data we collect, then perhaps the public might be more interested in what we do. And we can do a better job of telling the stories about how we did what we did and why it matters what we did, not just what we found.
Yeah. And do you think some of that might come down to the training of scientists? And the reason that I bring it up is that I think, you know, we're trained a lot, and in the scientific field, you're trained a lot on creating hypotheses and recording data well and reproducing it and being able to put fancy graphs together and interpret graphs. But there's never any aspect of training that goes into framing a story. I mean, it's you have scientific mentors as you go through, and they sort of can tell you how they tell their stories and what worked in the field, you know, for the past X number of years. But what do you think about putting creative processes in sort of any sort of, I guess, STEM type of field of, like, science, technology, engineering, math, anything like that? Like, what's the best way that we can incorporate that?
Yeah, it's tricky, because it's not really at the core of our training, and that may be part of the problem. Like, one of my mentors in science communication jokes that, you know, the only thing worse than scientists not talking to the media, because we often don't, we're too busy, science is hard enough, we're not trained, maybe a certain personality type gets attracted to science, it isn't necessarily interested in engaging with the public or the media. But so because of that, we often miss the important part, which is translation to real humans and, you know, citizens, taxpayers, the stakeholders for our work. But she said, you know, the only thing worse than scientists not communicating with media is more scientists communicating with the media. Because we're so bad at it. It's real work to learn a different communication style for a different audience altogether. And it takes practice, like any other kind of skill. So we're really good at, and we get trained at, finding gaps and asking novel questions and designing experiments to address those questions, and all the technical training you mentioned, and the analysis, which is sophisticated, and the interpretation of what it means or doesn't mean, and the synthesis to make new theories. And we get good at talking to other scientists. So we're still professional communicators. But that's usually where our scientific training ends, or our communication training ends, is talking to other scientists at posters or through the literature. And I think it falls down when it comes to, you know, thinking about a broad audience and what they're interested in. We get so, you know, and I'm guilty of this, and I have to, I always frame it when I do workshops on this as undoing the damage done to me, right? We get this damage done to us in terms of how we communicate, because we want to be clear and careful and accurate. And we get so caught up in the technical details, the methodology, and the caveats, that we forget to make a point. You know, we don't lead with, you know, a short synopsis of what the take-home message is, like a journalist might do. We start with this long-winded background about all the things we know, and then here's what we don't know, there's the gap, okay? And here's what we did, here's what we found, and here's what it means, finally. And then we pepper in all these caveats, because, you know, we're not going to be overconfident, what did Sam Harris say? You're more likely to find nudity than hubris at a scientific conference. So we're always so careful about, you know, our conclusions. But I think something gets lost in there, because most people who we might want to communicate with, it, where it matters, is someone who doesn't have our expertise and our background. And that's where this kind of storytelling perspective needs to come in, I think.
Yeah. And one of the things that I'd notice, and it's kind of a hard thing, you mentioned that scientists tend to lead with, here's all the caveats, here's all the things that we didn't prove, and then sort of bury the lead and put it at the end and say, but here's what we did know. And by the time you get there, they're so exhausted by caveats that it doesn't have that much impact. But at the same time, you know, within our field, or within, not even within our field, but within the scientific community, if you go on the other side and you just say that there's a certain topic, let's say, you know, there's a stomach ache. What causes a stomach ache? And you say, you know, this bacteria causes a stomach ache. Well, we know it's just, you know, one out of 130 other bacteria that can cause stomach aches. Like, that's even probably a short list. And so, you know, the normal scientific thing to do would be to say, you know, there's a million things that can cause a stomach ache. There's likelihood that you may have this one versus the other one. And, you know, so that may be the answer. And that's the real scientific answer, is because we don't know unless we test. And, you know, so it's, they're telling the truth. They're just not telling it in a way that actually makes sense to those that aren't used to hearing all the caveats first. And right. So, like you said, I mean, scientists themselves are good communicators to other scientists, but they're terrible communicators. I like the line that you said, that what was it, that the problem of science is not saying anything, but another problem is having too many scientists saying something.
Right. Yeah. It's bad that we're not talking to the public, but then if more of us are forced into it, particularly without training or interest, it's going to go badly.
Right. And that's where I wonder, when you see a lot of, let's say, the social media, you know, that's where a lot of information is just being pushed out, regardless of, you know, sometimes it's just funny meme things and other times it is scientific information. And it's one way of pushing a lot of information out to the media. And so when I think about some of the science things in social media, usually you see the accounts that are doing the best, or the ones that are pushing the most and getting the most interactions, aren't the ones that are necessarily having the most rigorous, hardcore scientific, you know, this is a fact that's being pushed that's undeniably true. But it's the one that just says, if A, then B. If you have this bacteria, you have a stomach ache. And then it gets, you know, a huge amount of interaction. And then you go into the comments and you see everyone butchering it for, you know, all the caveats that go into it. But from, and I know this is getting a long-winded question, but the reason I'm asking is because I think one of the fears that a lot of us in communication that are, you know, trying to push things out to the public, is that if you say something that you're trying to simplify in a way that makes it digestible, you kind of get scorned by the scientific community within our own scientific community. And so you're kind of damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. How do you reconcile sort of a balance between them? Or do we just, you know, need to, as scientists, just sit back and just relax?
Yeah, it's a very good question. It's I have to admit that, you know, because I was trained in a similar kind of way, and it serves me well in my job as a scientist, that I find it very difficult to reconcile. I'll just admit this, that I've taken some training in this. We're here to talk about this today. I do it, you know, professionally a little bit, outreach to public audiences. And I have a hard time applying some of these principles to my own scientific communication styles. You know, one of my mentors once said, you know, if you take scientific communication training to broad audiences, it will make you a better communicator to scientific audiences as well. And I really believe that we can all become better writers for any audience with some thought. But that's the trick, I think, is right there. Who's the audience? And that scientist who's listening to a radio program or this podcast or any other sort of project that's aimed at a public audience has to remember that they're not the audience. And I think scientists, you know, especially if you have expertise in the topic, you know, I think we have a tendency to go down the rabbit hole and say, well, that's not actually quite true, or not fully true, or it's only partly true some of the time, but we're not the audience, right? And so similarly, when I train my students in this kind of stuff, is to remember that that expert at the back of the room who's super intimidating, who knows more than you, is also not the audience. The audience is the bell curve, the average group of people in the room that probably don't know a lot about what you know. And so that expert back in the room, if at the back of the room, might be better served to stop getting hung up on, that's not actually entirely true, and just enjoy the ride. Enjoy that that person's teaching skills might actually be different than yours, and their ability to talk to non-experts or a general audience is actually really impressive. The ability to tell a story or use an analogy or find connections that aren't normally there. That's the impressive stuff. That's the hard stuff, actually. So I think sometimes you're right. Like, we beat each other up for talking, you know, Carl Sagan was famously beat up for talking to the media and trying to popularize science because it's not seen as serious. But with this move of the San Francisco Declaration on Research Assessment, so-called DORA principles that we're all being evaluated on now, we're being pushed to make and measure impact of our work in different kinds of ways. So the time is really right for us to start thinking about how to better make a splash to not just each other, but also to the public in some kind of way. And we're going to start getting evaluated on this, which may serve some of us better than others, but it's just a new way of thinking that is kind of in the air right now.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was in a previous episode, we had talked about sort of adding evaluations to tenure or to anything that went beyond just the science portion, but like, how good are you communicating? Like, one of the jobs is to push things out and to be able to make what we're doing publicly accessible. And along those lines, as you were talking about sort of the evolution of communication and being able to push it out and to know your audience. I like that, where kind of define your audience. I guess I've never even really thought about that. I always just
ought to be step one. I mean, we do this already, right? With any communication, we're thinking about a particular audience. We just have to shift our focus to a potentially different audience than we're used to communicating to, and everything should flow from there.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I like it. I mean, it's something that's not even considered. I guess I don't even recognize when I guess I do it because I give a lot of talks. I just kind of automatically, if I'm in a student talk, I give a student talk. And if I give, you know, a talk on a podcast, I try to make sure that we don't dive too far into the weeds, even though I still get hammered sometimes for going too deep in the weeds. But I think sometimes it's out of an interest rather than, like, to me, it's really cool to go into the inner workings, but I have to realize.
It's just why we found jobs as scientists. We like it.
Right. But I have to realize, like, that bores a lot of people when you get into it. And so I sort of lose the message. But, you know, one of the things that you had brought up, that idea of the mentor sitting in the background or the person sitting in the back row that is an expert on the topic and they're watching a trainee give a talk. You know, I when I go to some of the talks, I know from your trainees in particular, what I like is that they talk as though they're not afraid of saying something totally wrong. But yet at the same time, I think it gives them a better ability to speak about, like, they're not so focused on saying something wrong that they just say things that are right, if that makes sense. Like, sometimes you're so focused on making sure you don't say the wrong thing and you end up never actually saying anything or never saying the right thing. But it doesn't seem that there's an intimidation with you sitting in the audience, whereas sometimes you see a trainee give a talk and their mentor's in the audience and they look kind of physically scared. And then, you know, the mentor will jump in at some point.
Yeah.
But, you know, from a mentorship standpoint, is there anything particular that you do to foster sort of this environment where they're able to just kind of freely express themselves without worrying that you're going to jump down their throat? Or maybe you do in private, and then,
Well, I mean, we have to, you know, we often joke about, you know, hazing our trainees or you know, in residency training for physicians, they call it I'm blanking on the word now.
Pimping,
hazing. It's pimping.
Pimping. Yeah,
yeah. And so, you know, it's a part of our training a little bit to sort of beat each other up. To get ready, you know, your friends beat you up so your enemies can't touch you. So there is some of that in terms of getting ready for the hard questions from the experts. That's got to be there. You have to have the ability to flex when it's time. You don't necessarily have to lead with all that stuff, but you got to be ready for it in case it comes time. But I think this is perhaps going to sound like a tangent, but I did some improvisation training, some acting training, and Alan Alda does this with scientists as well. But improvisation training can actually go a long way. And I don't think it's operationally important in terms of like overcoming stage fright. But I think what improv training taught me was just to learn to be hyper-present in the moment and to be able to respond in real time to another person. Because that's ultimately what this is. And Alden says this all the time, like make a connection with your audience. That's the most fun part about speaking and communicating is find a way to connect with an audience in some way. And then I think people will be more forgiving if they don't entirely agree. And if they don't agree and the expert wants to stand up and flex, they might be gentler when they do it. But also because you've shown the human side, but also you still have to be ready to flex if you have to, I suppose. So we still have to know some things. So I would never say, don't worry about accuracy. Don't worry about knowledge. Don't worry about all that work we have to do. But it's really more about the delivery of it, to try not to be so paralyzed by the possibility that that expert in the back of the room is going to come at you. They're not your audience. The audience is the people that don't know something, and our job is to bring them along in an engaging, maybe even creative, maybe entertaining, but certainly accessible way that helps to teach them something and get some sort of idea across. And we don't do that, like you said earlier, with details and caveats.
Oh, interesting. I've never thought about improvisation like that before. I've played a couple different musical instruments for a number of years. Played trumpet for many years. And I'm in the process of learning guitar at the moment. And there's always those times when you have you're sort of forced to have an improv solo, and and the first few times that you know they give you a scale. There's a musical scale that you typically try to keep your improv within, and it kind of allows you to have some sort of boundaries that you can bounce off between, and so it doesn't feel like completely overwhelming. But I think comfort on stage definitely changed the ability to have an improv solo. I remember early on in my musical career, improvisation was terrifying. Like if I saw that little break in there and it said improv, I was sweating before the song even started. And then, I'd play like four notes and just over and over, just in a different pattern as best you could. Because you're so worried about it sounding bad. And then, then I start to realize, okay, as long as I stay within this scale, no note is going to sound bad. It's just how you're going to do it. What did they do it on the guitar? They call it I don't remember the scale, but anyways, there's different scales that you can use. A pentatonic scales, I think. Those are you have your safe pentatonic scales. But with the ability to have improv, and with that in science, or even just broadly more for also just communication in general, how, if someone isn't in a formal structure where they're given improvisation type of things, how does someone build up those types of skills of being able to be hyper present, if you will?
Yeah, it's good. I mean, I think I'm glad that you raised music as an example, because I think it's a perfect example. You have to have some chops. You have to have a little bit of background training to be able to get up on stage and play a musical instrument in front of people, and particularly with people who are doing similar things with you. But it's a template, right? You've got a pentatonic scale, you know what key it's in. I often use a blues song as an example, an analogy I train my students in. Like when I play music with my musician friends, if we know the tempo, we know the key, we know the in, we know some basic changes, and we know the out. If we're good enough and we rehearse enough, we can sort of find our way through it and respond in real time. And so we often joke, after shows, like, oh, Trevor really aimed for the ditch and we all followed him in. And so sometimes that happens, right? But if you're heads up hockey and watching each other and responding to each other, then it's not going to go as wrong because you're responding in real time to other people. So I like the template of a song as a way to think about a talk. So I often train students in a sort of 1 or 2 minute elevator pitch, and I give them a template. And there's a million pitch templates out there. But if you just keep in your back pocket the what, the so what, the now what, the what is like a little bit of background, define your terms, get rid of your jargon if you can. The so what, why do I care? Why should you care? Why is this important? Why is this interesting? And then the now what are we going to do? And so we're working on this sort of thing. You can change that around a bit, but that template, surprisingly, much like a blues song's template, gives you freedom because you know you're going to be okay because you'll fall back on that template. But the trick is to use the template to free you, not to memorize. Because if you memorize because you're paralyzed and you're scared, it'll come across as wooden and rehearsed, and you're more likely to screw it up. But if you know your stuff and you've done the work in the background and you're ready for questions that are beyond what you're going to talk about, and you frame it in some sort of template and you know what you're going to start with, maybe you memorize the first sentence or two, the thing you're going to say to get you going. Mm. Then you've had some confidence. Then you take a breath and you can relax and people are with you because they see that you're going to be okay, because they're on your side too, right? The audience wants you to succeed. They don't want you to screw up. Most audience members anyway. And then you can dance within that template, but you haven't memorized it, but you get it close enough, but you know what your out's going to be as well. And so if you kind of memorize your in, have a sense for where your changes are, memorize your out, you're going to have a better time because you're responding in real time to an audience. Then you can focus on them and their responses as opposed to just getting through it, talking too fast and hitting all your memorized talking points, right? So that's another sort of, you know, wouldn't say tip or trick, but tool you can use to relax a little bit when you're presenting to any audience, whether it's a 1 minute pitch or a 45 minute talk.
Interesting. What, so what, and now what? I think,
yeah.
I, even myself, I always forget about the so what and the now what. And like I was thinking, oh, maybe I definitely do miss the now what. And then I thought about it for a second more and I thought, oh no, I also miss the so what. But unless it's, you know, a question that's being asked, then you're sort of, you're prompted by this. Yeah. You're prompted by it. But speaking to that though, you know, the importance of improvisation and it building the skill of communication and building your ability to make an impact with the audience. So, I mean, it sounds like know what your goal is going in, understand your audience, and then figure out what, so what, and then also now what. So there's also something that they understand what happened, why it happened, and what to do with it in the future is a linear process that I think would take a lot of stress off of a lot of talks for individuals. I like that. Now, going into the way or the medium of which a lot of communication from sciences is pushed out, you know, we had mentioned, I talked a little bit about social media stuff, and I wanted to follow up on that in a second. But, you know, diving into the topic of publications and their role going forward in the future. You know, our papers that we write, so as scientists, you know, we create these papers, we push them out to journals, they go to peer review, and then we get, you know, the whole peer review process itself, which we can, you know, save for another time. But you push out these papers and they go out into the internet, into the ethos, and it's, sometimes it feels empty. It's like we did all this work, we put this data in, we pushed it out, and then 10 people in our field read it, but it's there to the public. If anyone wants to look it up, they can. Like, absolutely. But nobody's subscribing to academic journals outside of scientists, right? So it's just sort of circulating in this internal bubble that never leaves, unless there's some, you know, news article that comes out and they need a scientific reference, and then, you know, they tack on one scientific reference of a clinical study that happened. You know, with the advent of technology and social media pushing a lot of like information nowadays, or even with, you know, news articles like Google News or Apple News or anything like that, where does the scientific publications fit in going forward? I mean, are they archaic? How many people sit down and read the papers now?
It's true. It's a really pressing problem now. I mean, this is the advent of open access, which is tricky because, you know, who's paying for it? Now it falls on the researcher and their grants, their small grants to pay these open access fees that gets the public immediate access if they want it. So the initiative is right in terms of its goals, but its execution can be flawed. Now you get predatory journals as well on top of that. So it's that's ever merged with the open access movement. And that, you know, there's no meaningful peer review for those kinds of people are just paying to publish now. So it's a mess, really. You're right. I still think, and maybe this is the traditional training in me, and I'm curious what you think, but I still think that the peer review literature, like quality peer review, some other expert evaluating the paper for quality, novelty, you know, truthiness, all that kind of stuff, advances, you know, is still the gold standard, however flawed all that is. But it's, I think the message we're getting is it's not enough anymore. And as you said, like it's so anticlimactic, right? You get a paper in a, you know, moderately high impact journal, which is all I can hope for. And my trainees and I celebrate, and it's really exciting, but it's the most anticlimactic thing to experience. Because as you said, you never know if it's having impact. You never know if other people are reading it. Maybe an editorial gets written about it. Maybe other people reference it more or less over the coming years. Maybe it doesn't have an impact for 20 years. So I still think that basic science needs to grind along and do that basic work, curiosity-driven, novelty-driven background work, and you never know where it's going to go. But like I said, it's probably not enough anymore. And so we need to be better at telling the story to funding agencies, to the media. And honestly, you know, I got a little bit of press in the last couple of years on a few stories, that a few papers we published. And, you know, the media frenzy was actually some of the most fun thing about it, was like doing this kind of thing, talking to someone about the work, framing it in broader kinds of ways, trying to speculate about why they should care, or what makes it so interesting, or what makes it new and important. You know, one of the biggest wins was a New York Times article a couple of years ago, or a Scientific American article in the last year. Like, those are super fun things to be involved in, because you get to talk about it in more broad kinds of ways. And so, you know, that's the stuff that I get really excited about now, is not just getting the paper published, because we need to do that. Because that's still how we know things, right? Like, so I don't think it'll ever become redundant. It's the gold standard for how we know things. And if a paper's retracted, like in the case of the MMR vaccine and autism debate, it doesn't exist anymore. It didn't happen. It's not true. So we still need to publish primary literature. But I think telling stories now to the stakeholders in different kinds of ways to make it exciting, relevant, accessible, interesting is an emerging importance in terms of the work we do.
I like that. It's taking a little bit different look on it. I'm not saying that the science, like the papers are bad or not useful anymore, but they're not enough. And I guess that's an important way to look at it. And I think a lot of the debates that are going on right now about, you know, publishing, however, you know, however riddled with flaws that it may be, it still is the gold standard. And I've always thought that at the end of the day, sometimes, you know, you've had good reviews, sometimes you get bad reviews, and you just sort of take it on the chin and move forward. But I do think that peer review always in the end ends up providing a stronger product than what was originally submitted. And maybe I've just lucked out with good reviewers. Although, you know, like I said, I've had my chops rang a few times, and you sort of realize that, okay, maybe I didn't say what I thought I was saying, or, you know, I didn't interpret the things right that I thought that I was interpreting. But with the whole, peer review process, or not even peer review, with the publication process, we've seen a few sort of alternative types of press for papers, like directly from the academic space, of, you know, video journaling, or I know there's been some pushes towards, instead of a standard publication where you have a story that goes along with it, of a, you know, an abstract, an introduction, methods, all that kind of stuff. It's just a data repository where you just submit the data, and then it's just publicly available data and sets that you can manipulate and use however it is that you want to use, and could draw whatever conclusions that you want. And then you can just add some comments and things like that. You know, I don't know if any of those have ever really stuck. And same thing, there's definitely, and I'll save the names for which actual journals and stuff there are, but there's also, you know, the push for the journals that are non-peer review, where you just post the paper on there, and then some of them allow comments, kind of like you're posting a, you know, a Facebook post of the most rigorous scientific thing that you could. And then there's sort of peer review by a public domain, which, be it as it may, could be good or bad. You know, I don't know if any of them have taken off with the impact that perhaps they went in. They all sounded great to begin with. And, you know, I think maybe there's something to be said about, there's might be some old habits of scientists that kind of maybe prevent the push of some of those new things. You know, just seeing something new is always kind of scary to us, even though we're trying to always innovate. What other type of platforms or types of things do you think might be advantageous to add on top of the publications that might have an impact to actually get some more broad recognition?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what we're struggling with now is with, you know, like I said, our evaluation process is embracing this DORA model, this San Francisco Declaration of Research Assessment, to try and both make and measure and then articulate in our applications for jobs or grants the kinds of impact we're having. And, you know, for you and I, we're trained, and we're part of one of the last generations that were trained in quantitative metrics, you know, the number of students we've trained, the amount of money we brought in terms of operational funds, et cetera, the number of trainees we trained, the number of papers we published, the number of conference abstracts. It was always numbers and citation indices and all these kinds of things. And I don't think that it has to go away. You know, I think that still tells us something if someone's pushing really hard or not, and making a splash in terms of, you know, advancing a field. But I think, you know, in embracing this idea of broader impact, so much of it comes down to the discipline, right? Like a computer scientist might have a different kind of broader impact in terms of code sharing, for instance, than say an environmental scientist who might be helping write a white paper for the government and change policy, versus a physiologist who might help, say, astronauts mitigate, you know, risks of spaceflight and develop countermeasures to help keep them, you know, keep them healthy on their way to Mars. So, you know, impact can mean all kinds of different kinds of things. And so I think it's important for us to think about, okay, I'll do my traditional thing, my peer review paper, that's hard enough, sure. I'll train my students, you know, they'll go off and hopefully they'll get jobs too in meaningful places where the training paid off. But what else might my work serve? What other kinds of places might it be useful? And so I don't think it's a straight answer. I just think if enough of us start thinking this way, that maybe there's other ways that we can make an impact. And maybe it's starting a podcast like you did. Maybe it's engaging with the media more often and being on their regular sort of list for calls. Because the thing about the media is they move fast. And so you get a phone call, and they want to talk to you about something, if you can be really responsive and really open to it, you're more likely to get called again. So they need a roster of really responsive scientists who are good storytellers along the way. And so, you know, the more of us start thinking broadly about these kinds of things, then all of us collectively can make a bigger difference. I don't think it's fair to say every single one of us needs to be making a splash in all these different areas, because it's not for everybody. But I'm also probably not going to publish a Nature paper either. So that's also not for everybody. And so all of us collectively can move the needle a little bit to make science more accessible to the public, maybe more fun, entertaining, you know, cool, because we think it's cool. But maybe, and this is what my friend Jay said, maybe all we can do is make science normal again. I could just have it on the public tongue in lots of different kinds of ways. And if more of us are doing that, a critical mass of us start to move the needle a bit, and then maybe science might start to take a central role in the public imagination again, because it feels like it's fallen out of favor a bit. As Carl Sagan says, we've arranged a society around science and technology, and yet most people don't understand science and technology, even though they use it all the time. And now people are actively antagonistic toward it. So maybe we should stop. You know, we should get off of Facebook and stop arguing on Facebook walls and trying to give people evidence against their perspective, because that's not going to move the needle. That's just going to entrench them further. Maybe we should just focus on how cool science is and how interesting and maybe entertaining, but also normal and important it is. And collectively, we can maybe make a big difference together.
Yeah, so taking the broad perspective and actually, and as you were talking about that, I was starting to think of, you know, when you get into those regimes where you end up doom scrolling on Instagram or Facebook, we've all done it. So we all have to admit that we've done it. You look at the time and you go, oh man, I just threw away this time I'm never getting back, nor did I gain anything other than stress and anxiety. You know, but there really isn't a big wave of scientific, like actual peer-reviewed experimental scientific evidence that's being pushed. A lot of it's more, I don't want to say woo-woo, but a lot of it's more just hypothesis-driven. Like, we think that this is a rational reason why this happens, so clearly it happens. And then it gets taken by storm, and then, you know, you go down the rabbit hole, and then someone's going to say that that's the mechanism when there's no real evidence to support that.
But sort of having that massive critical mass behind where you can scroll on something and you find it interesting. You see some research paper or some research news that came out from a scientific study from some university, and then, you know, you stay engaged on it and you go again, and eventually the algorithm will kind of sort of self-clean itself after a while, I guess, depending on what it is that you're looking for. You know, but one of the things that's been curious to me when you look at some of the social media pushes for some scientific information, one of the things that seems to sell, regardless of whether or not the information is actually accurate, is the confidence that the information is delivered at. And I think we're kind of trained, not necessarily to dampen confidence, but to be our own worst enemy.
Yeah, it's true.
And so how do you balance that? How do you find a balance between having the confidence to say something is a certain way based on scientific evidence versus that coming off as cocky, essentially? Of you had talked about that there was sort of the pushback also towards the science, where our culture, our society is built upon these arts and science principles that were laid down. But then the actual, you know, ones that are the ones trying to advance that through experimental are sometimes pushed back against. And I think sometimes we are our own worst enemy. But how do you find that balance between delivering something confidently so that way there's trust, but also not sounding, I don't know, pompous, if you will? Is that a good word to use?
And people can smell insecurity a mile away, but they can also smell cockiness a mile away, right? And so how do you find the balance in there? It's tricky for sure. I mean, I think overconfidence without the chops to back it up eventually gets revealed. But we all know of examples of people that are overconfident but less accurate. And it does damage to science. It does damage to the public understanding of science, but also in the uptake or trust of science, right? So I think I heard Chris Hadfield, who's a Canadian astronaut, say once that the best antidote against anxiety or worry about performance is preparation, right? And so I think, you know, you can have confidence in two ways. You can have confidence because you know a lot of stuff. You know the caveats, you know what's true and what's not true and what's in the middle. You know some of the work in the past and what it's contributed and not contributed. That's all the stuff that we train our scientist trainees to do. And we're always ourselves getting better and better at that. But the other part of confidence comes in the practice of communicating in stories and telling data-driven stories as well. And I think a lot of scientists don't have that capacity or haven't developed the capacity. And as I said earlier, like, it's work to do this kind of stuff, to think about a different audience and how you might frame it to them. And I think if you bring to the table the preparation of having, I've done the work in terms of the background, I know this topic, I know what's true and what's not true, what's in the middle, but I've also done some work in the background around being able to tell the story in a certain kind of way. And I know why it might be important to some people, whether it's a disease that impacts a certain number of people, or it's just, you know, it's something that's timely, for instance. Then I think that the preparation on both of those fronts can give you not only some confidence to not be paralyzed, and then, of course, all those principles about templates and being ready to respond in real time, but also the humility to know what you don't know. Yeah. And then if someone points out that, well, you know, it's more complicated than that, you just say, you're right. I know that it is. And then you can express that too. But I think, you know, I like my comment about hubris overconfidence at conferences. You're not likely to see that except for maybe the odd person who stands up and has some bravado. But a nice balance of confidence, having earned it from preparation, and the humility of knowing what you don't know collectively, I think can probably push in the right direction, because I think people appreciate that human side.
So exposing some of the humanness to it can actually bring some sort of, I guess, rethinking of what might be true and what not. I think one of the best pieces of advice I ever got, to add on to what you said, is whenever you're giving some sort of talk in front of a large audience, always wear a jacket, for like a suit jacket, because it hides your sweat. You know, and eventually you just get, you wear the jacket initially because, you know, you're
armpits are sweating. You're sweating because you're nervous, but it hides it for a little while until you can get comfortable, and then you can finally like lose it. And then after a couple months of giving talks, but it was something stupid, but it was actually very effective. And I didn't realize how damp that I was, you know, when you're talking. Just builds up the stress. But anyways, I think a lot of that's just
like, it's, you know, we try and teach them how to be better communicators, but I think we should also be training each other all the time to be better audiences. Right. Because we know what it's like to give a talk to your audience who's not listening to you, or it's distracted but on their phone, or having that conversation in the back. It's distracting for us too, right? We're watching them just as much as they're watching us. And I think if we're all better audience members, and as speakers, to remember the audience is actually on your side, as I said before, like they don't want you to, they're stuck with you. So they want to be entertained, do something, right? And so if you remember that they're on your side and that the expert in the back of the room is not out to get you or isn't really your audience, I think that kind of stuff helps a lot too.
Yeah. And I've never really thought about it, about the way of being a good audience. I mean, we teach all of these things about communication and how to be a better communicator, but we never really teach how to be a good audience other than to not interrupt. I mean, just basic, you know, sort of respect type of things. But I think by giving talks, it kind of revealed what a good and a bad audience can be. And it sort of like created this whole cycle of, by forcing to practice talks and forcing to practice improv, you gain an understanding of what the speakers or the performers are doing. And so you're less likely to kind of judge. It's always like that age old adage of, usually the person that's judging you least in the gym is the, you know, the most jacked bodybuilder that there is, because they know exactly what it is that you're going for. The least critical amongst the people watching your show are the other musicians, and versus that of the common audience. And so it's almost like we have to force practice on improv. So we have to put people in front and make them do things to not only appreciate the fact that it is hard and there are things that we don't think of. You know, one of the things, whenever there's criticism that comes up sometimes from any little things that are said on the podcast, I always in the back of my head, or sometimes I'll even say, you know, it's a whole different ballgame when the recording is going and there's a little red light blinking in the corner. Because I think a lot of times you get so caught up and you're more focused about trying to like listen to yourself say a story, and you're more focused on, you know, your 5 or 10 words in front of you. You're never actually present. And I think it takes a while to be able to get used to being present in a conversation that you would actually normally have. Because you have a conversation with, you know, a long lost aunt at a Thanksgiving party. Like there's no recording, there's no pressure, there's no, like, it just sort of flows. You figure out what's going on, what's not going on. But you put it into a context of media where now you're under the gun.
Yeah.
And it's like your whole brain just goes to complete mush sometimes.
Yeah.
And I always say, like, some of the conversations, at least for this podcast in particular, I mean, sometimes the first words that you hear on the podcast is the first time, those are the first words that I've ever said to this human, like in my life. I've never met them. Like you're listening to the progression of us, even, you know, getting to know each other.
Yeah.
And it always takes like a little while. You can tell like the rhythm kind of finally falls in. But anyways, well,
we know each other already today.
Yeah, we already knew each other. We've known each other for quite a few years.
What you're talking about is the pressure of performance, right? Like a random conversation at a cocktail party, when you give someone your 1 minute elevator pitch about your work, is a much different thing than when there's an audience that have, you know, either paid for in a roundabout way or direct way to come see you or have an expectation of you. So there's that pressure of performance. And that's where I think some of this training can help you, you know, relax a little bit and not take it so seriously. Let the rope go a bit and just let it flow by trying to connect with that audience a bit more than just memorizing your 8 lines instead.
Be prepared.
And then throw it out the window. Like make your lesson plan and then crumple it up and throw it out the window. And then flow a lot better. Like you sent me, like any good podcaster, you sent me pictures, questions to prepare for before we started. And so, but we haven't stuck to that. And that's awesome, because then it flows a lot more, right? Like I had some things I wanted to hit along the way. And you gave me the chance to do that. But following the script doesn't really flow like a human conversation does. So hopefully we've done that.
Yeah. Yeah. I usually just send like a couple questions of, and I just put in the emails like, hey, look, these are just questions that'll kind of keep conversation points. If we hit them, cool. We're just going to kind of go wherever we go. But, you know, one of the things that I'm looking forward and now we're going to have to see if it happens. I've, you know, just when you're talking about communication, separating it from social media is inevitable. That and news sources, right? Those are our big pushes of communication for content type of things right now. And I'm sure it'll change in the future, but I've found a real joy in, you know, those times that I do look at on my phone and scroll a bit. There's this account that, and I don't have the name of it and I apologize, but there's this account that takes like scientific or just engineering or any type of content like that. That's sort of like a scientific math engineering type of content. And they sing it in a song to explain a concept, but they actually go into like pretty good depth. And I think it's partially because it's also mixed with really good graphics.
Yeah.
And it's almost like I can't turn away from it. It's like those popular mechanics things. So the question is when is the Dr. Trevor Day sing along going to come out?
Well, we're going to do it now, right?
Oh yeah.
You promised me that I was going to get to sing a song. No.
Oh my God, please. The song about the hippocampus that was going to happen live.
Yeah. I won science, art, and engineering mashup festival that we have in Calgary. I was on top of a crane with a ukulele, and I sang a song that were just bloody fishes in shoes, because it was like, you know, a song about breathing, and I was supposed to, you know, make up something fun for a general audience and a bunch of kids, and so that's what I did. I sang a song about us being fishes in shoes on a ukulele on top of a crane over an audience in a public square. So you never know what you're called to do once you open yourself to this world.
Yeah.
Weird starts to happen.
Then there you have it. We're bloody fishes with shoes. Yeah. which is true. But all right, yeah, well, thanks, Trevor. Thanks for coming on. We're right up on the hour already, so that always flies by. So I want to get you out of here in time. I know we both got we started the day in the lab with a gas explosion from our compressor. So that was you know, yeah. as you would also know, whenever you have compressed gas over time and generators that run for like 30 years without turning off, it's inevitable. But
so it happened. I've never had it happen to me. you started your day with a gas bottle explosion.
Oh yeah, it was just a gas line that it has a float valve in there that it has. So this is a nitrogen generator. So it takes room air and then it scrubs out the oxygen and it gives you nitrogen. So we have a constant supply of 100% nitrogen. Yeah. In the process of that, it produces liquid. It produces steam, it produces water, whatever. And it goes into this reservoir that has a float valve. And then when it hits a certain point, then it drains out to the drain. And all of this is like trying to go through in compressed lines and stuff. And the float valve, similar to like a toilet, got stuck open. And so it was just constantly pushing out and had way more pressure than the drain line was able to handle. And so it went boom.
No.
And so we were, well, you know, because then I ran into the lab and there was this gas line just comically like a snake flying around with, you know, I think it had 110 PSI in there. So it was, it was whipping. And then I got it. And then we quickly realized that I didn't build the system. We have no idea how this system works or where this line is going to. And none of the hoses are color coded. And so it became a game of, in this loud room of, you know, me behind some giant tank shaking the line and then asking down, which one of these is moving?
Oh God. It's good you're telling the story, because I think it really plays into what we're talking about today, that these kinds of stories about how things are done and the disasters that happen along the way, because this is never neatly captured in any of our scientific papers, you know, how difficult something was or having to build something from scratch that didn't exist and that, you know, the thing going wrong. One paper in one of our journals talked about an electrical fire in Kathmandu at a hotel that we were setting up labs, you know, like, it was a rare moment where an author captured that. But it's just, we never talk about it, but you know, it's human beings screwing up in a lab space all the time. That's actually what science is. But the stories we tell so neatly in scientific journals never capture that stuff. And maybe, you know, and that's a good thing to end on, maybe is we need to be doing that more to show the human side of it, to show the struggles about who we are and what we've overcome, but also the challenges of building things that don't exist to get something to work. I think that makes science way more interesting than the clean little stories we tell in journals.
Yeah, that's what we need to have, some sort of like short form documentary that goes with each paper, and then
right.
And
you'll results, yeah,
you'll see the disaster. But I think it also, in a sense, it adds to the rigor of, you saw what went into actually getting the. It wasn't like we just randomly got some animals, we threw them in a box, and we saw what happened. And there's a rigorous process that goes into it, and I think maybe it would shed light, and I don't know. Maybe add some trust. You see the faces and you see what's going on. But, you know,
we started today by talking about, like, you know, science on stage and art and science together and that kind of stuff. And I think that's the thing that I'm left with after this, what I'm reminded of with all this stuff is that science and art are really the same kind of thing. They're just different approaches with the same goal of trying to understand, interpret, express ourselves and our place in the world. And so art and science aren't so different, even though people often think that they are. They're both really just human endeavors, and both artists and science are just human beings, flawed human beings, with their own perspectives that they bring to it. But ultimately, both things are expressions of our understanding of our place in the world. And that's why I like both of those things. And I think that's why the two of them can often belong together more than we often think.
Yeah, that's what. Perfect way to end on. Art and science, we need to merge them. We need to bring the arts into the science. I think the arts are more likely to bring the sciences in than vice versa. So there you have it.